You're listening to Idea Collider, a show that explores the world of asymmetric learning. On this show, I will sit down with pharmaceutical experts and business leaders to discuss how to embrace uncertainty and the different learning style that follows. I'm your host, Mike Rea. Let's get into the show. In this episode, I talk with John LaMatina, who is a wonderful author and contributed to Twitter and a few other companies on his book, Pharma and Profits. If you know John, you may even remember him from a video we did a few years ago in a round table where he provided his elegant insights into the way the industry works and could work better as it attaches to innovation. And his book, as you'll hear, is a passionate defense of the profit incentive in pharma, but also how it works and how it doesn't work so well. So listen to the way that he describes insulin as a product, for example, and understand that it is important for us to rigorously defend the parts of our industry that are valuable, to be clear that where we're not adding value, we need to be honest and transparent about that as well. But I think this is an important riposte to some of the stories that we hear told about how big and evil our industry is. You'll see how deeply human John is in the way that he approached life in a corporate structure and in some of the ways that he approaches it in biotech as well. So I know you will very much enjoy this episode on the book Pharma and Profits. John LaMatina, thank you so much for joining me on Idea Collider. Before we dive into the great book, I think, which is a great contribution to the conversation around reputation, around price, around value, can you tell us a little bit more about you and how you got to the point of writing this book?
Sure. So I'm a chemist by training. Went to graduate school here in the United States and eventually got a PhD. And in 1977. I went to work in the labs in Pfizer in Groton, Connecticut. They were the main labs at the time for Pfizer globally. And I stayed there for 30 years and eventually rose up, fortunate to become head of all of R&D and global perspective. And then after 30 years, I left Pfizer and did what people like me normally do. We go into biotech, serving on boards or as advisors or things like that. But I also started writing, and the reason I wrote and the reason I still write was to try and show the various misconceptions that people have about a pharmaceutical industry, particularly the R&D aspects of the industry. So I wrote a book called Drug Truths, Dispelling the Myths of Pharmaceutical R&D. And that got that did pretty well in terms of getting people's attention and eventually led me on to a television show here in the United States called the Dr. Oz Show. Mm-hmm. And that was not a very great experience. And I got to learn firsthand about how negative people were about the industry. So then it sort of changed my narrative a little bit in terms of trying to understand the other position. And then I wrote a second book, Devalued and Distrusted, Can the Pharmaceutical Industry Restore Its Broken Image? And again, tried to address some of those things. But also with my second book, I started to try and get my message out more. I joined Twitter, started a blog, and that has helped a little bit as well. And I didn't have any great desire to write more books until in the last few years, drug pricing in the United States has gotten to be an unbelievable issue. Not in terms of people's concerns about how much they pay for drugs, but again, the misconceptions and the errors that are out there as to how drugs are priced and what the facts are, which are totally misconstrued. And I'm assuming by naivete, but I also think because of some people who just have very negative views of the pharmaceutical industry. And so with this trilogy of books, what I've tried to do is go out and talk about the industry, talk about the importance of it, and talk about the industry's needs and the need to support itself in going forward. And I guess what really brought it all home for me was during the pandemic, particularly before the vaccines were available. A number of the interviews and discussions I had with the media were around this. And again, misconceptions about about how involved, how much. So, for example, with Pfizer, Pfizer is the most expensive of the vaccines out there. It's the initially $39 for the two doses. And I remember being interviewed by a British journalist who said, well, you know, Pfizer is anticipating making $36 billion in the first year of sales. How much should they be allowed to keep? And I was just flabbergasted. And I told this interviewer, I said, you know, we had such a crisis. I'm a native New Yorker. The pandemic was so bad in New York, they had refrigerator trucks outside the hospitals. They just couldn't get all the bodies to the morgue or even keep them in the morgue. 800 people a day were dying. And now you have a vaccine, and not just Pfizer, Moderna, J&J, and Europe, AstraZeneca, et cetera. You have vaccines now that are preventing these deaths and saving the healthcare system almost $1 trillion. There was a paper that came out earlier this year that estimated that besides saving 17 million hospitalizations in the United States and besides saving over 2 million lives, it also saved the healthcare system up to that point, $899 billion. Mm-hmm. And you're begrudging Pfizer for getting $56 billion the first year and maybe 52 in 2022. I guess that's the latest projection. Give me a break. But, you know, people hear, oh, God, Pfizer must be price gouging this. And then, of course, there's the view that, well, everybody knows these vaccines were really discovered in academia and funded for it. All Pfizer did was make it. So, you know, you have to go back to square one with people and teach them how all this stuff happens, how it's all funded, and the risks that people take. So it's been trying to counteract these misconceptions. And I would have thought, if anything, what the pandemic taught was the value of the biopharmaceutical industry, and not just the companies that came up with vaccines, the companies that tried to get vaccines and it didn't work out, but there were enough people doing it that we had opportunities there, but also the companies that came out with antibodies and therapeutics, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know many companies that weren't doing something, either looking at the symptoms, preventing antibodies to prevent it, trying to treat the disease once you had it. Everybody did this. And you know, that the cynical person is going to say, of course, that's because they knew they'd make a lot of money on this. Well, no, it's because their own families were getting COVID. They had elderly relatives or neighbors or friends or worried about their own kids and grandkids of getting this virus. So and I would have hoped that with that, people would have had some appreciation. And it has been, in fairness, in various Gallup and Harris polls, the industry is doing better. But even that's starting to erode away now. And people are starting to come back to some of their concerns about costs. Yeah. If you let me stay on this for a minute, what amazes me is that, and there's no doubt in America, we pay more for drugs than in the rest of the world. But to a certain extent, the amount isn't clear because what only gets published are list prices in the United States. And for those non-American viewers that you have in the United States, you have list prices, but that's not a real price. That's just the price that's put out there. And then prices get negotiated, much like prices get negotiated in Europe or in France. In the United States, we don't have one country. We don't have a single buyer system, but we have basically three major insurance companies. Now, 80%+ of Americans are either in CVS, United Healthcare, or one of the other company insurance company. And so Pfizer, American, Lilly, AstraZeneca, everybody, they all negotiate with these healthcare companies. And so the actual price that gets negotiated is secret because nobody wants to know that Pfizer doesn't want to let CVS know they gave United Healthcare a better deal or whatever. So when you see these price stories about, well, prices are going up and up, well, that's list prices. That's not the price that the company actually gets, which is different. Still, I would argue probably still more than perhaps in the UK and in France, but not nearly as much as one might expect. And now I want to contrast this with something else, and then I'll let you ask a question again. But what people don't focus on are hospitalization costs or other healthcare costs. So drugs all over the world only make up about 13 or 14% of the overall healthcare bill. The rest is doctors, hospitals, clinics, other supporting healthcare operations. Well, in the United States, and this is somewhat public, a hip replacement costs about $40,000. My focus on hip replacements, because I had a lot of friends who are now getting them. I'm a certain age, but it's becoming more common in my social group. In France, it's $10,000. In Poland, it's $2,500. Fact of the matter is, all healthcare costs in this country are way more than in other places. So why do people focus on healthcare? For the most part, in the United States, people have to pay insurance, and they have deductibles when it comes to their drugs or co-payments, et cetera. And so that's visible. They actually see that. They normally don't see the costs of what a hospital gets along the way. And to put a cap on all this, I'm old enough that I'm in Medicare now in the United States. And so every quarter I get a statement, tells me how much Medicare is paid for whatever procedures I've had, et cetera. The Pfizer, I'm a Pfizer loyalist, obviously. So the Pfizer vaccine for the two-shot regimen initially cost $39. And for each shot after that costs $19.50. When I go to the local pharmacy, CVS, Walgreens, et cetera, they get from Medicare to put the injection in my arm, $43. They get more than double what the innovator got for coming up, discovering, distributing, et cetera, these vaccines. Nobody's aware of that. They just know that, Pfizer's making 50 some odd billion dollars each year for their vaccine. And the other part about going to a pharmacy is that you have to wait around 10 or 15 minutes to make sure there's not ever. So you're sitting there and you're also buying things, right? While I'm here, I need this, I need that. It is the greatest come on, I think, these pharmacies have ever had here in the United States in terms of drawing up business, and they're making a ton of money. Again, nobody knows this stuff. Now, I'm happy to have a discussion with anybody about drug prices and what's fair and not fair, but let's get all the information on the table. And so you can start weighing things along the way and start seeing what the necessary trade-offs may or may not be.
No, I love that bit in the book. So I didn't know that, right? When you said that was at Yale New Haven Health that was being reimbursed. And I guess your visibility on that was striking, because you said, what is it? Yale received $50 for your vaccine, for your vaccination.
And what Yale did was they rented out a high school field house, basically a big high school gym. And it was great. I mean, they did a good job. They had volunteers. You walked in. And I have to tell you, getting that shot, I just felt I had this enormous burden lifted off my shoulders. And that was just the first one. But you sort of said to yourself, we might get out of this. And you just felt great. So I don't begrudge them the fact that they got, 40 some odd dollars for putting the shot in my own. But they didn't have to lay out, they didn't have to build a building. They didn't have to pay all sorts of people to do it. This was a pretty inexpensive way of doing this. And it was the way, obviously, of the government to try and make sure that there would be places who would actually give the shots. So that's the financial inducement to do that. Eye-opening.
Keen to get to that piece because there was things I didn't know about, the manufacturing machines that they were buying at such huge cost and so forth. But maybe let's start at the start. I mean, post your Dr. Oz moment, your introduction is around the Sovaldi issue. When we launched a cure, there's something that I didn't know in there, which is that in many parts of the United States, you paid less than Europe was paying for that pill. So could you?
So for your audience benefit, it's probably about 7 years ago now, Gilead came up with a drug called Sovaldi that cured hepatitis C. Hepatitis C is a silent disease. Most people don't know they have it. They've been infected with probably getting in contact with certain type of blood, infected blood, but it can lead to liver failure, cirrhosis of the liver, liver failure, liver cancer, and perhaps the need to get a liver transplant. So it's the leading cause in this country anyway of liver cancer. And so it's a pretty devastating disease when you can get it. The treatments before Gilead's drug came out were basically based on a biological molecule called interferon, which didn't work very well, only worked maybe 40 or 50% of the time. You had to take the drug for an extended period, 6, 9 months, maybe longer. And when you took that combination of drugs, the old combination, you felt like you had the flu. Now Gilead comes out with a single pill that you took every day for 3 months. And not only is it almost 100% curative, but you're just taking a pill and you feel fine. You don't have the kind of side effects you had with the old interferon-based drugs. And by the way, the old drug regimen would probably run on the order of $100,000 a year. So Sovaldi came out and it was priced at $1,000 a pill, which was $84,000 for the treatment. Better, more effective, safer, and a little bit less cheap, not as expensive as the former treatment. Well, the headlines that came out about it were people holding the pill and saying the $1,000 pill and talked about how expensive this was without any of the other details. Without the details, this is a major breakthrough. You're going to, in the United States, liver transplant costs on the order of $300,000-$400,000, right? So you're saving an enormous amount of money to the healthcare system along the way. Furthermore, that was the initial price. Within a year, AbbVie had their own version. Merck came out with one sometime later. And the competition drove down the price for a cure for hepatitis C down to $22,500, which is an unbelievable bargain compared to things were. But the ironic thing about all this was that I was at a conference when Sovaldi was out and then when AbbVie's molecule came out. And the head of one of these insurance company healthcare systems basically cackled about how well he was able to negotiate Gilead versus AbbVie, that he was said, we're now paying less for the hepatitis C drugs in my program than the people in the UK or in France or in Germany are all paying. Now, Germany and France, we knew that it was $55,000. So again, it's the crazy US system, but somebody was willing to say, we're paying less. So it must have been the order of $45,000 or $50,000. And that's even before even more competition came in. But that's the craziness of what's going on. And so nobody ever came back and said, oh, you know, never mind. We're actually paying less for Sovaldi than they are in other countries. Or even when it came to the coming back to the drugs to treat COVID-19 and the vaccines, which the United States is paying exactly the same as other countries. It was a global negotiation fee that these companies have put in place. So again, I'm sure people will come up with examples of expensive drugs here that are more expensive in the UK. And the UK, for example, has their organization called NICE, which will basically look at the price of a new drug and determine if it's worth it or not, or what the price should be. But we're now, unfortunately, slowly going to this same setup in the United States if this new legislation passes in the coming months.
Maybe. I know there's a lot of pushback. I mean, you know, in the book, I like to quote, if you do the math quickly, about 60,000 US veterans will be cured of hepatitis C for about $25,000 per soldier treated. That's not a number that does make headlines, but I think I felt there was some hubris from Gilead when they launched that price, and were almost proud of it. They didn't take any. They didn't take the time to explain you're doing, the kind of value of it. So you know, I think they invited some of that. I think there's some sadness that, you know, if you look at the number of people with hepatitis C in the States today versus when they launched, that there are more people with hepatitis C now than when they launched Sovaldi. So you know, I think it's such an interesting question. Is, you know, could the dynamics of our healthcare system change? I think you addressed the prison populations and others where it's you know, still relatively expensive. But
well, you talked about the veterans, and in the article that I first read about that, they say their goal was to wipe out hepatitis C in the veteran community, which I think is a terrific thing to do. But they qualified it by saying, for those people who are willing to take the medication to have their hepatitis C cured. Which is, you know, you have vaccine hesitancy in this country and other places as well. But just the fact that they were able to get this cured didn't mean that everybody was going to try and take advantage of it. And the same thing holds true here as well.
Yeah. And then if we flip into, I mean, the, you know, you talk about the payers, but this, you know, great conversation about PCSK9s, which I think is one of those, you know, genuinely interesting marketplaces where, as you said, the value of lowering LDL was unproven. So which would the payers kind of used against the companies that launched this stuff? So, you know, could you give us a hint of, you know, where you're coming to that story?
So this touches on so many different things. First of all, again, for your audience, two companies, Regeneron and Amgen, came up with a biological molecule that worked wonders for lowering LDL cholesterol. LDL cholesterol is one of the leading drivers of atherosclerosis and heart disease and heart attacks and strokes. Now, we already have statins, and most people who need a statin, including myself, can easily get a statin now. They're generic. They cost pennies a day, which is another miracle of life sciences and the drug industry, that you come up with something like a Lipitor or a Crestor, and you get it on the market, and you make some money back. And Lipitor, at its peak, sold almost $13 billion a year. And then the next year, it went off patent, and that number dropped by 90-some-odd percent. So, again, Kuczynski coined his term the Great American Drug Deal. But beyond statins, will get your LDL level down to about 100. And if you've already had a heart attack or stroke or have a strong family history of heart disease, you want to get that number down even further, even lower than a high-dose statin is. So these companies came up with drugs called PCSK9 inhibitors that, when combined with a statin, lower your LDL to unprecedented numbers, to 30 or 40 milligrams per deciliter. And so if you're somebody who's had a heart attack, you want to be on this right away. Problem was that Gilead, Amgen, and Regeneron were charging roughly $14,000 for a year's therapy. Now, this is not a pill. It's an injection that you have to get twice a month. It's more expensive to make, et cetera. But the price was high. And so, unbelievably, insurance companies refused to let patients get the drug. If you want to get it, you have to get it on our plan. You have to pay for yourself. We're not going to pay for it. Now, that lasted only until Regeneron and Amgen published studies that showed that you actually do lower heart attacks and strokes. You know, what people don't appreciate is the advances in medicine that drug companies make to prove the value of their drugs. So insurance companies first said, so who cares that these drugs lower, you take your cholesterol from 100 down to 50. That might not make any difference in terms of heart attacks and strokes. Prove it to us that it's worthwhile. Well, these companies did. And in fact, these studies cost on the order of $1 billion, $1.5 billion. They did it. They showed it worked. But even then, so the point here is that nobody was going to fund a study like that, not the NIH, not National Healthcare Service. And only the big companies really have the money to do this sort of thing. So just as part of all this, a basic principle was established that if you want to get your LDL as low as possible, below even what a generic statin can do. And that's what these drugs do. So anyway, that came out. This still didn't help sales much because you would hear cardiologists saying, I'm having a heck of a time getting the insurance company to agree to let my patient on these drugs. I've gotten it back 3, 4, 5 times before they agreed to it. So the insurance companies made it pretty tough until the companies lowered the price by about 60%, you know, on the order of, I think, $4,000 or $5,000. And I have to estimate because, again, it wasn't really public. You just heard rumors and you can sort of read between the lines along the way. But this really teaches an important lesson here, and that is that just because you have a drug that works, it has great results in clinical trials, it gets approved by the FDA, doesn't mean it's going to be a success. It doesn't mean patients are even going to get it, because insurance companies now are the new gatekeeper on all of this. And that was totally new in my regard. And then one final thing that I had never experienced before, and I'm still amazed by, in order to get onto insurance company plans, these companies had to make money back guarantees. And so you think to yourself, well, these people have heart disease. They're likely going to eventually proceed to heart failure over a decade or so. How can you give a money back guarantee? You're not going to prevent that. You're going to prevent any sudden heart attack. And so what they did was they went to the various insurance plans and said, okay, if your patient goes on our drug and gets a heart attack within 6 months, we'll reimburse you and then set up a grid to do all that. Unprecedented in my experience for what is a major medical breakthrough, great science using genetic technologies to come up with something new to help fend off and give longer life to people at risk of heart disease. Money back guarantees, insurance companies preventing you getting the drugs. It's a new world.
No, I was I was close to Zell Khoury, and I knew, the Zell Khoury story from the inside out. Right? I wasn't aware of the rest of the history that you talk about from, whether it's inclisiran or the PCSK9s and the way that they then bargain those things through, right? Yeah. So, we'll take the surrogate marker, then we'll take a money-back guarantee. So there's a really interesting bunch of references in that. But I think it's one of those things where, your conclusion in that chapter that, that payers can make or break a product, and it's not just enough to get an approval. I mean, that's, you're singing my song there. I've always felt that there's such an important consideration. But actually, I want to loop back to something you said in that chapter about the value of Me Too, because it's easy to dismiss the Me Too as a ripoff, right? The companies are just interested. But as you point out, Lipitor was a Me Too and is the best of the statins with Crestor. The look at the PD-1 class, or you look at bococizumab as a PCSK9 as a Me Too that didn't make it to market. So I really liked that illustration of, drugs are different. They have different value. Improving the value is part of the cost.
There are academics who belittle the industry if they don't come up with a first-in-class drug. Right. You're just copying others and say, well, first of all, nobody starts out to get a second or third-class drug, because usually research starts at the same time and people are working very hard to come up with an important new drug. Oftentimes, the first drug isn't the best that comes out there. It may have some flaws that the second one coming forward will correct. But also, as you've seen, competition helps drive down price. Having multiple choices in a therapeutic class is important because, surprisingly, not every drug works the same for people. I've had people come up to me and tell me, they had weird effects on Lipitor and Crestor worked far better for them, or vice versa. Yeah. But if you want to think about it, the ultimate Me Too drug is the Moderna vaccine. Pfizer was first, only by about a week or two, but it was the first one out there. But weren't we grateful to have choices, because we needed as many vaccines as we can get? And thankfully, you had a bunch of companies going after mRNA COVID-19 vaccines, not just mRNA ones, but others, because nobody knew if an mRNA vaccine would work or not. So you had basically tremendous competition going off to come up with something to get us out of the pandemic. And thankfully, it worked.
If we flip to the pandemic chapter, there's a bunch of stuff I didn't know in there about Pfizer's upfront cost. I mean, I knew that they hadn't taken the warp speed money, that these were conversations that were taking place at the time, but partly that was down to speed and agility. Partly that was down to, Pfizer's been there before, as you point out, with penicillin. I hadn't been aware that they were a fermentation company when they said that they'd do that. But if folks don't know that, it was Pfizer's ability to manufacture penicillin that, was a significant contribution to their winning the war.
When we left your country to go to France on D-Day, 90% of the penicillin that went with the troops was Pfizer made penicillin, and infections was some of the leading cause of death in the war, the fighting, but also infections went a long way to help saving a lot of Allied troops.
Tremendous. And such a huge asymmetry. I mean, the fact that we had Pfizer on our side was absolutely part of the asymmetry. But you raised the idea of like profiteering from the pandemic. And I don't think people do know the costs of investment that go into not just the studies, but as you said, like the manufacturing machines. The fact that some companies didn't make it at all,
great companies with a history of vaccines, weren't successful. It's unbelievable. Yeah. It's not an easy thing to do.
Yeah. So could you maybe just give us a sort of 2-minute history of what a decision to say yes to taking a vaccine forward would look like at Pfizer, from your chapter?
Yeah, well, the irony is Pfizer didn't get into vaccines while I was there. I left a couple of years after I left. They bought Wyeth Pharmaceuticals, and Wyeth had a vaccine business, and that brought things in. But obviously, I still follow them very closely and know a little bit about their history here. The pandemic breaks. And the CEO, Dr. Albert Bourla, I don't know Bourla. We overlapped a little bit, but he was in animal health at the time. So it's not as if I'm sucking up to an old friend or something like that. Bourla calls everybody in on a Friday and basically says, on Monday, I want your best ideas to go after treatments, vaccines, whatever. It turned out Pfizer already had a collaboration with BioNTech in Germany because of Pfizer's interest in vaccines, and they had a pneumococcal vaccine that's actually a very strong product for them. And they were looking at new approaches to treating the flu. Flu vaccines are notoriously inefficient. If you get a flu vaccine and they're giving it as 50, 60% effective, that's great. In fact, last year, it was only 18 or 19% effective, at least here in the States. So they were looking at this technology for a flu vaccine. And the team came back on Monday and said, you know, we think we can adapt the BioNTech vaccine for a COVID vaccine. In fact, BioNTech's already started on working it to see if they can come up with something. And so they were already working on it. The CEO and this leadership team says, okay, let's take a look at this. They had calls with the heads of BioNTech and in unbelievable fashion had a handshake, not even a handshake, probably a Zoom handshake agreement to go ahead and do this deal, which is incredible amount of trust between two leaders and two companies. And thank God they got along and came to pass. And then they went to town working on it. And independent of even knowing such a vaccine would work, they invested in it. And at the time, Birla said, well, you know, we knew we'd have to invest. We weren't going to take any money from the government. We didn't think that was the government's place to fund a place like Pfizer. Furthermore, it might cost us $1 billion. $1 billion isn't going to break us. It ended up costing $2 billion along the way. And let me say that he said, yeah, it's not going to break us. Here's a guy who's been CEO maybe for 18 months. His previous year's sales were $41.6 billion. He's now throwing $2 billion into an unprecedented technology, and he's building manufacturing plants already in two major places, one in Europe, one in the United States, around the world. Are you kidding me? You know how much guts that takes? But his view was, this is for all of us. This isn't just to make money.
And actually, you make reference to the support that the board gave him at the time.
Well, that's another thing. I have to say, he benefits from a Pfizer board, which is unbelievably strong in science. Not just one or two token scientists, but really Scott Gottlieb and Sue Desmond-Hellmann, who used to run the Gates Foundation, was with CSF, and a professor at University, Helen Hobbs, at the University of Texas Southeast Medical Center, and an immunologist from NYU, and a couple of other, I mean, six strong scientific types. And so, you know, the board has somebody to turn to other than the CEO. And I think that's important for these major drug companies to have. We had some scientists, including Nobel Prize winners on the Pfizer board when I was there, but not to the degree of this. And I think that's important. In a case like this, gave them the support, gave them the backing, which was really crucial in going forward. And then I want to make two other points here. One is that a lot of people are saying, well, you know, this was really done with NIH money and they really discovered all this. The real credit in terms of funding early stage mRNA vaccine work goes to venture capitalists. You know, Moderna existed for 10 years, all on VC money, basically, before it yielded anything. And these were people basically betting this is technology, but people underestimate or have no appreciation whatsoever of the investments venture capital companies make in early stage technology like this, which is a very important part of the ecosystem for drug R&D. And the other group that has to, actually two other groups, the Operation Warp Speed in the United States was a tremendous thing because they took some billions of dollars and bet on, it might've been $16 or $18 billion, and bet on six different technologies, you know, two mRNA, two et cetera. I think AstraZeneca, Pfizer, Moderna, J&J, Novavax, and one other. Some of them didn't yield very well at all. AstraZeneca actually never got approved in this country. But the fact that they made all those bets they had to give money to the smaller companies for development. Moderna, Novavax, they had no money to develop anything. But Pfizer, I don't know if they gave anything to AstraZeneca. If they did, it was more. But you needed to give those small companies the ability to be able to manufacture. So that was important. But then finally, the FDA and the CDC deserve a tremendous amount of credit. I mean, they were working with these companies almost on a weekly basis, hand in glove, design the trials. This is what you need to do. Let's help it back and forth. And that's all of that the investment ahead of time, building manufacturing facilities, people in the companies going all out, working all hours of the day, the FDA working closely, et cetera. 9 months time, it's just unbelievable. I can remember people saying, Ken Frazier at Merck, CEO of the Merck Dynamics. Ken Frazier was a terrific CEO. I have a lot of respect for him, but he had an article basically saying, hey, be careful of overpromising. Everybody's saying you get these vaccines quickly. He says the fastest we ever developed a vaccine was a mump vaccine in 2.5 years. It's going to be at least 1.5 years or more to get the vaccine. And he's an expert, right? He knows what he's talking about. So the fact that we cut the timeline that Frazier thought would be optimistic in half is a remarkable achievement that a lot of people deserve credit for.
Yeah, and you give credit to the folks that were able to think about, manufacturing, to distribution, to getting studies on. You actually, you talk about some of the missteps that folks like AstraZeneca took with their, the research and so forth.
That happens.
Yeah, and that point about risk is it's not linear or necessarily predictable in some of those ways that people think it is. But let's leap to the bit about the federal investment in R&D, because it's something that's used to hit the industry a lot, is this idea that all the hard work's done in the lab and then after that you're just stamping out the pills. I mean, can you give us an intro?
Drives me absolutely crazy in this country, where, and particularly in politicians in the United States, they'll have a hearing. And one hearing in particular about a year ago, where the Congresswoman from New York basically had a Harvard professor on being questioned about this, and said, and she basically came to the conclusion that basically, it's the people, Americans, who are funding with their tax dollars the NIH to make all these breakthroughs, and then these big companies come in and simply swoop up the technology and make the pills and sell them for enormous profits. We're not getting any return on investment whatsoever. And of course, the Harvard professor agreed, which he should have known better, because I know him and he knows better than this. Well, so let's now get to reality. The NIH, like every other institution, does basic research. In fact, the United States for over 100 years, and in Europe, England, France, all countries invest in R&D, largely for defense purposes, but a lot of it for health, space exploration, and things of that nature. In fact, if you were to take your iPhone and look at it, most of the technology in your iPhone is based on research that was funded by the National Science Foundation, right? So you would never think to go to Apple and say, well, I'm an American citizen, I pay taxes, we funded you, I should get this at half price. Yes, that's absurd. Now, one would argue that the $100,000, 100,000 people working for Apple right now, or the billions of dollars they pay every year in taxes, is helping to reinforce the coffers here. But what the NIH does, it funds, is basic research, 90% of which fails, because all of basic research is hypothesis and testing. And even then, if you have something that looks promising, you come up with an enzyme, perhaps, or a target where you think, boy, if I block this in mice, you might have a way to treat cancer. Oh, great. All right. Well, that's as far as they can go. Now you have to say, okay, well, that might be right, but A, I got to find a compound that blocks that. Two, I got to show that the compound actually works in mice or rats or dogs or monkeys or whatever. I got to show that it's safe. I got to show it's selective, that not only does it seem to block this enzyme in a mouse, but it doesn't also cause mice's livers to fall out, rot away. That whole process takes years, 3, 4, 5 years. Then you finally get something that looks like it might be worth going into humans. And then you do all sorts of preclinical studies, toxicology studies, selectivity studies, et cetera. And then you go to the FDA and say, we have something interesting. Will you let us put it in humans at a single dose, at different dose levels, to see if it's actually safe, that people don't throw up, fall over, stroke, or whatever? Then you go through that. That process takes a year and a half. You have to go into what phase two studies to show that it actually may have an effect in that disease. And then you've got to do big phase three studies, which I alluded to earlier with the cholesterol drugs, that can cost on the order of, depending on the nature of the disease, $1 billion and take 3 or 4 or 5 years. The whole process takes from idea to getting a drug approved at best 10 or 12 years, and it could be 15 or 16 years going forward. And depending on the analysis you go through and who you believe, can cost upwards of $3, 4, 5 billion to do that. Now, what the NIH did in identifying a potential target is valuable. And it is an important step, and I liken it to running the first mile of a marathon. You don't run the first mile, you're done, right? If you break your leg in the first mile, you're out of it. You still got 25.2 to go, and that goes, and they get each mile after, it gets harder. And on your body, you'll have to have a lot more expensive consuming energy. That's what drug R&D is. So the thought that, you know, the NIH funded basically the discovery of the mRNA vaccines, or the NIH funded discovery of anything, is not true. Yes, they play an important role. Yes, the scientists there are terrific. Yes, it's a great starting point. And yes, the industry, my whole biopharmaceutical industry, does applied research. We do basic research as well, particularly in other parts of drug discovery. But that part of the drug R&D ecosystem starts in an academic approach. No doubt about that. But stop. Stop it when you talk about, you know, they've really discovered things and all these companies are doing are just manufacturing these pills. Give me a break.
Yeah, it's too easy an insult. And I like the way that you took the Zeljan story from, you know, first conversation through to a real drug. But I think that the thing that you just said is so important for people to realize is that if that basic research starts to come with a different cost or a different license arrangement, then you stop doing it. And that's the thing. Most of the R&D in this space is done by pharmaceutical companies. It's not done by...
And Mike, we've run that experiment. So in the 90s, most of these discoveries at the NIH were just sitting on the shelves because there was a clawback clause that the government put in, say, well, you know, if you do this, then, you know, you're going to have to pay us royalties, whatever. So they said, no, we don't need to do that. And then finally, Congress realized the mistake and passed a law that basically said you can get a non-exclusive license to these things. And that caused an explosion then of this work to be start looking at and exploited, which is needed to be done.
Mm. So if we leap to, I mean, the other thing that people, you know, like the congresswoman in challenging things, we'll talk about the price of insulin, you know, you devote a chapter to that and this sort of essential observation that people will use it and people like Bernie Sanders will drive buses to Canada to purchase it, but it's not the product that was, you know, that everyone talks about being given away in the beginning.
So insulin is an unbelievable story in this country. So first of all, let's start with the misinformation. Misinformation is that I've heard politicians say this even recently. Well, insulin's been known for over 100 years. There's no improvements have been made on it, and yet people can't afford it and are literally dying because they can't get insulin. Okay, first of all, that's not true. The insulin that was initially discovered was insulin from an animal. For 60 years, it was pig insulin. Eventually, Genentech was able to clone human insulin. That human insulin, in fact, you can go to Walmart in this country and buy without a prescription. I didn't believe this, so I went and actually tried it. And the lady at the counter said, well, what kind do you want? There are three different kinds, long-acting, short-acting, intermediate. And it costs $24.88 for a vial of it. A vial will last about 3 weeks, I believe. But you shouldn't go, if you're a diabetic, you shouldn't go on your own and just buy that insulin and use it because you have to be under a doctor's care. Why do you have to be in a doctor's care? You have to carefully measure how high and how low that insulin is. And furthermore, it can lead to comas, can lead to weight gain. Human insulin, ironically, isn't so great. Better than pig, but not the ideal. So what happened in the 90s? Drug companies like Sanofi, Novo Nordisk, and Lilly, I believe, went out to improve upon Mother Nature. They took insulin and made synthetic modifications to it to come up with a better insulin. These better insulins, insulin analogs really, had to go through full clinical trials, full FDA approval procedures in order to have them reach the market. And they're great. And that's what everybody wants. They want the stuff. You take it, you have these injectable devices. You inject them. You don't have to worry about going too low during the night, too high. stuff. They're great new drugs. Well, weren't great new drugs because now they're generic. You can now go to Walmart and get these things. So Bernie Sanders, instead of taking his people to Canada, could have just gone to a local Walmart and gotten them insulin, although they can do better elsewhere. Now, so where's the disconnect? You know, Lamontina, what are you talking about? Why are all these people complaining? Well, there are people paying money in their insurance programs. Now, the other fact that people lose is that 75% of people in the United States are already paying less than $35 a month for their insulin. Why $35 a month? Because that's what Congress has been rallying about. Nobody should pay more than $35 a month. I agree. Nobody should pay more than $35 a month. No problem. But only 25% of the people, 25% are still paying a lot more. Well, a lot of those people don't have insurance. Amazingly, 10% of the people in the United States have no health insurance. So whose fault is that? You know, government, why don't we create a plan where everybody can get insurance? And then you take a whole other swath of people away from this problem. But then the other problem is that, and this is an amazing discombobulation of our healthcare system. These companies that in the last 5 years were delivering, Novo Nordisk, Lilly, et cetera, negotiating with the insurance companies for their insulin, because you had competition again. You had three different companies negotiating to get on the formularies of these insurance companies. Well, every year, the net price, the list price of these insulins were going up 5, 6, 7% a year. But the amount of money that the actual manufacturers were getting was going down every year. Well, how can that be? Well, the insurance companies have people who have co-pays. And so what will happen is you're in an insurance program, they're going to charge you a certain amount. The difference between what the company gets and what the insurance company negotiates goes back to the insurance company. It's not as if they're doing this for the patient. So they're making their money. People are in co-pays. And when they get their co-pay up to a certain amount, then their insulin gets fully covered. So tell me how screwed up that is. But who is getting the blame? It's the drug companies. You know, everybody's saying, well, you know, these insurance people can't afford their insurance. Bernie's taking people to Canada because they're going to die without getting their insulin. They're paying, and there are people paying $100, hundreds of dollars a month for their insulin. But that's either because they don't have insurance or their copay and the type of program they have is sort of screwing all the way. It's got nothing to do with the drug companies.
Yeah. And you show the decline in the net price of Lantus over time. I mean, it's, you know, it's
exactly
it's
right. And that's stunning. And it was nice that basically they came public with those data because you can now see something in perspective.
Yeah. Yeah. And at the other end of the spectrum, you know, you've got a great chapter on gene therapy and this kind of one and done challenge that we have is how do you calculate the value of a medicine and then a price? Because I think you make this point well through the book. It's not just the bottom up price that we're charging for our medicines. The value of a one and done therapy, especially in the States and the way that you have the system built, presents a sort of maybe a reputational challenge or maybe it's a kind of commercial challenge for the industry.
A little bit of both. But interestingly enough, what's happened in the last few years is that companies coming. So for the audience's sake, you now, I was one going to a big healthcare meeting that happens every January in San Francisco called the JP Morgan meetings, conferences. And I got in a cab, and this goes back about eight years or so. And cab driver said, "You going to the meeting?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, you know, all these drug companies, they have cures for diseases." I said, "Excuse me?" He says, "Yeah, they have cures for these diseases, but they're not letting anybody know about them because if they cure a disease, they have no market. What are they going to sell?" At which point I said, "You know, you can let me off the next corner. I've gone pretty far enough in your cab." But it did raise an interesting point. What happens if you can cure a disease? What kind of business model is that? And that's not science fiction anymore. As you said, there are now gene therapies that do this. And I use an example, the therapy that treats childhood leukemia now. And how do you price something like this? Well, you can do all sorts of calculations. In the United States, we haven't had this conversation yet, but what is the value of a life worth? You have that in the UK. I believe it's 30,000 or 40,000 pounds. So if a new drug comes out and it restores good health, not somebody bedridden with IV tubes in them, but restores good normal health, that drug is worth 40,000 pounds, maybe $50,000 here in the United States. But we don't know. We haven't had that crossed that bridge in the United States. But in any case, what Novartis did, because they came out with this drug, was to charge, I think it was $2.1 million dollars for this gene therapy, payable over 5 years. And obviously, if the gene therapy doesn't take, it'll either they refund the money back or continue the therapy longer to see if it'll or repeat therapy to see if it will happen. But it's a real interesting problem that the industry faces, but it's real and it's going to come. But now you start getting into the hard value of a new drug. So you cure a child with leukemia, a child would die at age 2 or 3. To the Dutch child's family and parents, it's invaluable. You can't put a price on that. It's worth whatever. But the rest of society pays for it. So how much do you put in? Well, if you start factoring in what this person will contribute as they grow up, become an adult, pay taxes, maybe discover the next major cure or solve world peace or whatever, you know, it's could be a pretty important. So these are harder discussions to have. But what, as I alluded to earlier, companies are now going to payers and going to insurance companies, going to the NHS in the UK and say, okay, we have this drug. We think it's going to do da, 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 da. What, here's what we're thinking of. Here's the value we think it brings. A whole other science of pharmacoeconomics. Here's what the value we think it brings. Where do you see the value? And how much would you be willing to pay? And they're doing that with countries, and they're doing that with the insurance companies here in the United States, which are sort of mini countries in a lot of ways. And so that's also something that 5 years ago never would have happened. To be honest, a company would have come up with a number, thought it was fair, and they just launched it at that number. Now, a lot more discussion is coming on because they want the next pill to come out, not that it's $1,000 for the pill, but rather new cure for the whatever is coming out, and your insurance company is willing to reimburse for it.
Yeah, no, it's interesting that, and one of the challenges is right that I think if two narratives exist, which is that we're charging high prices and pharma is a huge profitable business, you know, those two things coincide, right? And that suddenly creates a negative reputation. But you've got a great chapter on kind of is pharma as profitable as people think. Could you explain a little bit more about that?
Well, it's not an industry losing money, obviously. Mm-hmm. It's an industry makes profits. You have to make profits, otherwise you go under, right? Like any company would. But if you compare it to other industries, and I have tables in the book that compare, it's there are other industries more profitable than the pharmaceutical industry is. And by the way, the pharmaceutical industry invests 25% of all its top line revenues into R&D. No other industry does that. It's a phenomenal number. If you think about it, and this will come to the next point I'm going to make as what's about to happen and how this is going to be impacted in the United States and therefore across the globe, is that for every $1 billion in sales, a company invests $250 million in R&D. Tremendous amount of money in R&D. And as I said, as a percentage, no other industry, Google, Apple, no other industry comes even close to investing this amount. So obviously then, anything you do to limit the sales of a company is going to impact its R&D. So now in the United States, Congress is getting pretty close to passing a law that's going to start putting in price controls for drugs after they've been on the market for seven years for small molecules and I think 12 years for large molecules, which is inane and for all sorts of reasons. But no matter what that, you know, and now there's the dueling data. Congress puts out one set of data. The University of Chicago puts out a second set of data. And then, you know, the numbers are all over the place. How many fewer drugs we're going to have? I come to this at this very simply. You're going to have fewer drugs because you're going to be investing a whole lot more in R&D. Probably maybe about at least 10%, maybe 15% or more. And that's real billions and billions of dollars. More dollars than the NIH invests in any year. So then you have these, of course, you know, people who criticize pharma who say, well, just invest in the right drugs. Don't invest in these Me Too drugs that we talked about a little bit earlier, that nobody technically really invests in Me Too drugs. Or, you know, pick the winners sooner than you do. Don't waste resources in things. You know, it's as if this is so easy. You just go on a menu and you pick out, that's the whole invest in and make this. It's just not true. You're going to have less money to invest in. Yeah. You're going to have layoffs in the industry. And furthermore, because you can't do as much research on it as much people, right? So that will all go down. You will get fewer drugs, no doubt about that. But then the other crucial part is you're going to get less investment by venture capitalists, because what they've been investing in the past is the hope that you know, one out of eight projects makes it to the end. So we'll try and invest in a bunch of them to get one out there. Well, now it's going to get a little bit more dicey because there's going to be fewer things to invest in. And furthermore, the government is putting sort of like shackles on small molecule drug research. Because those, you know, you're not going to get as much return on in just 9 years. So maybe we don't invest in the small molecules, which, by the way, are cheaper to administer, cheaper to make, become generic more quickly at lower prices. The exact wrong thing to do going forward. It's just inane, but it's going to happen.
Yeah. And some of the statistics that you quote, was it 14% in 2017 of publicly traded biopharma companies had a positive net income?
Yeah.
65% of the companies in other industries would. And what was it? The top 50% of 728 publicly traded pharma companies had a weighted average profit margin of 7.5%. On the bottom 50% had a loss margin of minus, it says 11,000%, but I was stunned by that number. So it was a tough business to be in.
Absolutely.
With the amount of risk.
Absolutely.
That sits here.
But when there's a pandemic, who do you turn to?
Yeah.
You don't turn to the NIH, you don't turn to Harvard, you don't turn to Oxford, you go to biopharma.
Yeah, and you gave a great personal story of the impact of having to cut, from your time at Pfizer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The hardest part of my career was doing that. And to put in perspective for the audience, basically, I had to take out effectively, for a variety of reasons, about 15%. Of what the budget I needed to maintain what we were doing and pushing the portfolio forward. And you just couldn't do that with minor changes here or there. We had to close research sites, including in the UK, France, Japan, and a 2,200 person site in Ann Arbor, Michigan, the late legacy Warren Lambert Park Davis site. And you want to talk about impacting a community, you know, in these communities, in Sandwich, for example, as well as in Ann Arbor, they estimated 3 to 4 jobs in the community had their roots in the jobs at Pfizer. For each job at the Pfizer labs, you had, be it real estate agents or cleaners or restaurants or whatever. You take out that, it impacts your whole community along the way of jobs that people, most cities and towns crave. So it's unbelievable what's going to happen.
Yeah. So is that a bit where people think the industry is hugely profitable because they see some headlines?
Yeah.
There's also a bit of... that, you know, that was brought up in Peter Kolchinsky's book and on this podcast, of people don't realize how small a part of overall healthcare spending pharma is, you know, compared to the cost that is always rising. You know, there's no generic colonoscopies that are taking place in the United States. Did you think that's a story that needs to be told, you know, more or?
Absolutely. So as I said earlier, people have no feel for how much healthcare costs. You could, if some miracle occurred and there were no costs to the healthcare system for new drugs, none. In 7 years' time, the amount we're spending today in the United States will be that number and set the same in 7 years because it's only 15% of the healthcare budget. And healthcare costs go up 5, 6, 7% every year. So it basically, in effect, will wipe out that amount of money. But more importantly, drugs keep people out of hospitals. As we talked about with the COVID vaccines and how many millions of hospitalizations and billions of dollars, almost $1 trillion saved in hospital and healthcare costs thanks to the vaccines. These are things that save money. We should be doing everything to foster that, not help tie their hands behind their back.
Yeah, and I like your last chapter about the schemes, where everyone has their scheme to lower drug prices. But even there, the debate, as you say, is so... you know, lacks nuance, whether people are attacking the Humira type situation versus the price of new drugs is not a question that's often raised. So, you know, it's certainly no one short of ideas, but they start with the false premises that you just elaborated.
And Mike, I'm happy to have a discussion about this, but let's get the facts on the table and let's see what's really going on and then step back a little bit. Right now in this country, for the first time, The congressmen and women are getting the thought that, what are these PBMs doing? Why are all these rebates going directly into their pockets and not back to them? What's happening here? They're just discovering this now after, you know, a decade of this happening. Yeah. So, but it's starting to happen slowly.
Yeah. Plus, you're also sitting in a country where you know, we have to thank for the pandemic response. I mean, we've had some from outside. I mean, AstraZeneca, I think, had a good role, but you know, Moderna, Pfizer, you know, they're where they are for a reason.
Yeah, and I don't want to focus just on them, because a lot, you know, you have to give credit to even those places like Merck or GSK that weren't successful, but yet took the time and effort and focus on trying to do that. They would also try, you know, some people worked out, but we all benefited from it, thankfully.
Nice. Last few minutes, John, obviously I'd recommend people read this book. Are there books that you would recommend other people read? You know, whether it's on the subject or anything.
The Great American Drug Deal is an important thing to read. I think that Kulchinski's argument is good. I think, again, sucking up to the Pfizer CEO, who I don't know, I think his book, Moonshot, is a wonderful story about the decisions they made and how they did things, etc. Gives you real appreciation for what's going on. Unfortunately, most of the books on this industry are negative about the industry, and I'm not going to dignify them by giving them mention. But there are a number of books that attack the industry. And fine, you know, you want to attack the industry, and you've got facts to do it. By all means, you want to talk about these, but have facts. Don't, you know, it's just the old tried and true thing about the cancer drug that only extends life for a month by $100,000. Well, I don't agree with that either. You know, so I'm not even putting something like that on the table. Give me a break. But you know, let's talk about how much drug companies actually make. Let's talk about the value that drug companies actually bring. Let's talk about how these drugs save the healthcare system lots of money.
Absolutely. And folks like Billy Kenver, who was on this podcast, Gerald Posner, they have facts. And, you know, some of the IRS director at the opiate, you know, the opiate companies or other Sacklers or other things. But I think these are really interesting conversations to have with people, you know, like you said about Peter Bark. I mean, this is a man with strong opinions, but also, you know, he's open to a nuanced conversation about this stuff. Yep. So, because we're all working towards something better. John, I enjoy every time I talk to you.
Same as Mike, appreciate it.
I don't know what the word for a four book series is. Is there a next one?
Oh, man, I just finished this one.
Yeah,
well, I'll tell you one problem I have. My first book I dedicated to my wife. My second book, I had one grandson at the time, I dedicated to him. The third book, I had three new grandchildren, and so I dedicated to those three. But 6 weeks ago, our daughter gave birth to our fifth grandchild. So I'm getting some comments from my daughter and her husband saying, well, what are you going to do for our little girl? Well, I'll wait to see when they're done and then maybe consider something else. So maybe at the sake of keeping family peace, I'll do one more.
Yeah, well, I welcome the dedication and the product of those dedications. So thank you for writing it. And even more, thank you for coming on the podcast. It's been wonderful.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's it for this week's episode of Idea Collider. To continue the conversation, visit our website at ideapharma.com. Follow us in your favorite podcast app so you never miss an episode. Don't forget to rate and review us on Apple Podcast. Until next time, I'm Mike Rea, wishing you great success.